So one of my favourite things to do when I'm kind of bored or when I've got some free time, when I'm just sitting on my computer on the stand of Google, is to search the most biggest, grandest, awesomest things of the world. So some random things like this. What is the world's biggest house? And now you're interested, so I will tell you. The world's biggest house is the Istana Nurul Imam Palace, which is the home of the Sultan of Brunei. And you want to know how big it is? 27 football pitches big. Now, anyone would be happy to have a house that's maybe one football pitch big. But this is 27 football pitches big. And sometimes another cool thing is, who has the most Instagram followers? Who is winning that race of popularity? And at the moment, it is Cristiano Ronaldo with 286 million followers. Now, to get your head around that, that's like everyone in England following him 5 times. And another thing I often quite kind of keep my eye on is, who is the richest person in the world right now? And as of speaking this, as recording this, the race is like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, and at the moment it's Jeff Bezos, and his net worth is $186 billion. Now that doesn't mean it's in his account, literally, but his assets, his net worth is $186 billion. Now let me try and help you get your head around that. If 1 million seconds were to go by, that would be 11 days. Now you can probably get your head around that. Now, 1 billion seconds. If 1 billion seconds were to go by, that is 36 years. Now, if you were to do the maths, and I've done it for you, and I think I've done it right, if we're trying to get 186 billion seconds to go by, that would be around 6,696 years. So you can just kind of can't really get your head around Jeff Bezos' net worth. And if we were to bring it down into like kind of like creation and what we can possibly go and visit, there's some crazy, crazy places that can kind of blow our minds as well when it comes to numbers. Take the Mariana Trench, which is the world's deepest ocean. And it has a depth of 11,034 metres. And you want to get your head around that? If you wanted to run the depth of the Mariana Trench, you'd have to run around the Olympic running track 28 times. And what about the world's tallest building? It once used to be the Empire State Building, but now it's the Burj Khalifa in Dubai, and that is 828 metres tall. And if you have offices at the top of that building, or if you have a home, I don't know what is up there, that building sways either like 6 foot or 6 metres to stop it snapping. That's some like engineering craziness right there. And you think about the world's tallest waterfall, which is the Angel Falls, it's 979 metres. Just imagine that. A waterfall, 979 metres. And think of a place that I would love to go to before I go and meet Jesus face to face. It's the Grand Canyon. Grand Canyon in America, which is basically a massive hole. 277 miles in length. 6,000 feet in depth in certain areas, and 4 to 18 miles wide. Crazy numbers. And these are all kind of just head knowledge by our massive numbers. Just like trying to get our heads around them are massive numbers which we can't get our head around. But if you have been lucky enough to go on and visit the Mariana Trench, if you can do that, if you've been lucky enough to visit, go to Dubai and visit the Burj Khalifa, or you've seen the Angel Falls, or you've been to the Grand Canyon, then you now have more than head knowledge. You have heart knowledge. Because these are two different things. Head knowledge is an unlived experience, where heart knowledge is a lived experience. And this is similar when it comes to God. All of us who are listening to this have some kind of head knowledge of God. Whether right or wrong, we all have some kind of head knowledge. But from our head to our heart is about an 18-inch journey. And that journey from just knowing stuff about God to actually knowing, believing, trusting and experiencing God is a difference maker when it comes to trusting Him with all that goes on in our lives. But even with heart experience, It doesn't mean that we have it all together. It doesn't mean that we fully trust God all the time. It doesn't mean that we fully obey him. We read countless historical stories in the Bible of the group of people that God chose, the special people, the Israelites in the Old Testament, who had amazing, miraculous encounters with God, but yet still doubted and were still disobedient. Take example, the story of, it is a story in the book of Exodus, which is the second book of the Bible. And basically the Israelites have been enslaved to the Egyptians for 400 years. Every single day, all the ancestors, everyone has been working day in, day night, 7 days a week, working for the Egyptians, enslaved by the Egyptians. And God leads them out of Egypt, frees them from their captivity. The Israelites are on the sea edge. They're being led by Moses. And suddenly the Egyptians are coming to capture them. Pharaoh's changed his mind and he wants them back. And what does God do? We all probably know the story. He splits the sea. Walls, meters and meters high. And the Israelites walk through safely. And then the Egyptians come running through the sea. And God collapses the wall on them and destroys the whole Egyptian army. What an amazing encounter. A miraculous encounter with God. Surely that is enough of an encounter. Enough of an experience of God. For that group of people, the Israelites, to trust God with every aspect of their life. But two chapters later we read that they're complaining, that they're hungry and starving and that God isn't providing for them. And that they would rather be back in slavery in Egypt because at least they had food. And we see this time and time again where God does amazing things, miraculous things for the Israelites. And they had these amazing encounters with God. At the micro and macro level, only for then the Israelites to struggle to fully trust and to be obedient to God. And as we jump into the Isaiah series, this is the first one, we jump into the Isaiah series, we jump into a time in history where God has allowed his people, the Israelites, or a better way to put it, has allowed them to go down a path of destruction that they wanted to go down, and they're about to be captured by a surrounding nation. And you think, well, what have they done this time? You know, because if they always do this, you know, what have they done this time? Basically, this time, they've been a nation of idolatry. They've been a group of people that have been idolizing and disobeying God. And God has allowed them to go down that path of destruction. And they are about to be captive. So what we're going to do is we're going to go big and look at the whole bit, think about Isaiah. And we're going to get closer and closer and closer to the chapter that we're going to look at today. So chapters 1 to 39 of Isaiah deals mainly with the kingdom of Judah, and in particularly the city of Jerusalem that was within the kingdom of Judah. The city was still standing, so it hadn't been destroyed yet, but there was a threat of invasion from the Assyrians who had captured the northern kingdom of Israel. And Assyria was kind of like, it's like northern day Iraq, and the Assyrians were known as this kind of had this like warrior culture, and that kind of descended into that their army as well. So many nations would poo themselves if the Assyrian army was surrounding them, and they had this ruthless kind of army that didn't take any captives. They were going to get what they wanted, and that was surrounding the kingdom of Judah. And then we have kind of chapters 40 to 66. And when reading from, like, if you were to read Isaiah from beginning to end, when you hit chapter 40, you're kind of waking up 150 years after, like, the chapter 1 to 39. And in that 150 years, Judah, which is the lower kingdom, has been captured and oppressed by the Babylonians. But we wake up on the far side of that captivity, so it's kind of nearly over. And then we kind of focus again in on 40 to 48, which are going to be the chapters that we're going to be looking at over the next 3 weeks. And this is like kind of like anything over the chapters 40 is where we all start getting our highlighters out and saying, oh, that's an amazing Bible verse. So we all start highlighting it because there's a feel in these chapters of liberation. There's a feel of hope in the air. There's comfort in the air. And there are promises of a new exodus with God leading the way out himself. And there's a new theme emerging for the people of Israel, which is to reveal the glory of God and be a light to the surrounding nations. Which leads us to our first chapter in this series, which is chapter 40. And I'm going to be reading from the New Living Translation. So if you have an app, the YouVersion Bible app, whatever, you can switch the translation now. And it goes like this. It says, "Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem Tell her that her sad days are gone and her sins are pardoned. Yes, the Lord has punished her twice over for all her sins. Listen, it's the voice of someone shouting, clear the way through the wilderness for the Lord. Make a straight highway through the wasteland for our God. Fill in the valleys and level the mountains and hills. Straighten the curves and smooth out the rough places. Then the glory of the Lord will be revealed and all the people will see it together. The Lord has spoken. A voice said, shout. I asked, what should I shout? Shout that the people are like the grass. Their beauty fades as quickly as the flowers in a field. The grass withers and the flowers fade beneath the breath of the Lord. And so it is with the people. The grass withers and the flowers fade, but the word of our God stands forever. O Zion, messenger of good news, shout from the mountain tops. Shout it louder, O Jerusalem. Shout and do not be afraid. Tell the towns of Judah, your God is coming. Yes, the sovereign Lord is coming in power. He will rule with a powerful arm. See, he brings his reward with him as he comes. He will feed his flock like a shepherd. He will carry the lambs in his arms, holding them close to his heart. He will gently lead the mother sheep with their young. Who else has held the ocean in his hand? Who has measured off the heavens with his fingers? Who else knows the weight of the earth or has weighed the mountains and hills on a scale? Who is able to advise the Spirit of the Lord? Who knows enough to give him advice or teach him? Has the Lord ever needed anyone's advice? Does he need instruction about what is good? Did someone teach him what is right or show him the path of justice? No. For all the nations of the world are but a drop in the bucket. They are nothing more than dust on the scales. He picks up the whole earth as though it were a grain of sand. All the wood in Lebanon's forest and all the Lebanon's animals would not be enough to make a burnt offering worthy of our God. The nations of the world are worth nothing to him. In his eyes they count for less than nothing, mere emptiness and froth. To whom can you compare God? What image can you find to resemble him? Can he be compared to any idol formed in a mould, overlaid with gold and decorated with silver and chains? Or if people are too poor for that they might at least choose wood that won't decay and a skilled craftsman to carve an image that won't fall down? Haven't you heard? Don't you understand? Are you deaf to the words of God, the words he gave before the world began? Are you so ignorant? God sits above the circle of the earth. The people below seem like grasshoppers to him. He spreads out the heavens like a curtain and makes his tent from them. He judges the great people of the world and brings them all to nothing. They hardly get started, barely taking root when he blows on them and they wither. The wind carries them off like chaff. To whom will you compare me? Who is my equal, asks the Holy One. Look up to the heavens. Who created all the stars? He brings them out like an army, one after another, calling each by its name. Because of his great power and incomparable strength, not a single one is missing. O Jacob, how can you say that the Lord does not see your troubles? O Israel, how can you say God ignores your rights? Have you never heard? Have you never understood? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of all the earth. He never grows weak or weary. No one can measure the depth of his understanding. He gives power to the weak and strength to the powerless. Even youths will become weak and tired, and young men will fall in exhaustion. But those who trust in the Lord will find new strength. They will soar on the wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not faint. And in these two sections, well, just give it away. In this chapter, we have two sections. The first section, like kind of two themes. The first theme is like in 1 to 11. And it is God comforting his people. And then the second theme, in the kind of second section, is 12 to 31. And God is basically asking the question, who is my equal? Who is my equal? So let's go to the first theme, which is 1 to 11, where God is comforting his people. Over 100 years, God's people have been captured, enslaved, and oppressed by the Babylonians. And now God is comforting them with his words, which are always true. Let's take a look at some of these like comforting words and verses. Verse 1, comfort, comfort my people. Not with strength. He's not going to comfort them with strength so they can overcome their captives. This has a more of a gentle tone to it. A more like hugging kind of gentleness, comforting to it. Comfort, comfort my people. Verse 2, speak tenderly. Her sad days are gone. Her sins are pardoned. God is literally, guys, it literally means speak to the heart. The phrase is most founded in the Bible when it's talking about winning someone back. Hard service has been completed. God is saying, I'm speaking to your heart. Be reassured, I'm bringing you back. Your time in captivity has been completed. Verses 3 and 4, clear the way through the wilderness. Fill in the valleys, level the mountains, straighten the curves, smooth the rough places. God is saying, whatever is in the way of you and me bringing you out of captivity, into the wilderness and into freedom, will not stand in my way. And in verses 6 to 8, people are like grass and flowers. Their beauty fades and withers, but the word of God stands forever. God's people have been in captivity for 100 years. And there's like this kind of like comforting stuff. And all this comforting words could be quite wishful thinking if it wasn't for the end of like verse 8 where it says that the word of God stands forever. God is saying, look, Israelites, my people, what I say is true. I am comforting you. I'm going to bring you out of captivity. And in verse 10, this amazing comforting kind of truth. See, he brings his reward with him. The exiles, the Israelites, God's chosen people are God's reward and he will bring them with him. He will lead them out of exile, out of captivity and into freedom. So, 100 years of oppression and God starts his journey out into freedom with comforting words, with closeness, with tenderness, with gentleness. Which leads us to theme 2, which is 12 to 31. Who is like God? Who can you compare God to? Who is his equal? And this like 12 to 31 is this amazing poem which rebukes Israel for their small ideas of God and their flagging faith. And in this poem, we see God as creator and disposer. And the universe is dwarfed by his presence. And the goal of this poem is to get to verse 31, which is that those who trust in the Lord will find new strength. This poem is kind of saying to Israelites, Israelites, would you stop? Stop replacing God with other things. Israelites, would you stop doubting God? Look what he's done for you in the past. Look what he's continuing to do for you. Stop doing that. Trust in God in order that your strength will be renewed. And then we kind of move into this like, well, matter, mind and creation. You know, is there any person that is like God? Who else has held the ocean in their hand? No one. Who else has measured off the heavens with their fingers? No one. Who else has weighed the earth and everything in it? No one. And then we kind of come to the mind. Is there any person on this earth that has a mind that can be compared to God? Who is able to advise God? No one. Who knows enough to give God advice? No one. Who can give God instruction in knowing what is good? No one. Who can teach God what is right? No one. Who can teach God? Who can show God the path of justice? No one. And is there anything that's been created that can be compared to God? Well, no, because in this poem, all nations in the world are but a drop in the bucket to him. All nations are nothing than dust on the scales to him. And God picks up the earth like it's a grain of sand. Does this not empty then the meaning out of everything? Does this not empty out the meaning of our complex minds? Does it not empty out the meaning of our amazing bodies that God has given us? Does it empty out the meaning of creation and the universe? Not at all. Because we don't find an identity in everything that has been created. We don't find it in that. We find our identity, we find our meaning in the one who has created it. So in light of this, church, I have one question for us to think about. How big is your God, really? How big is your God, really? The whole story of the Israelites throughout the Old Testament are ones of moments of undeniable faith and then a journey towards complacency and lack of faith. You know, the Israelites are like, God does some amazing things and they have trust in him and they follow him. And then the time goes on, they get complacent. They get complacent when God doesn't do what they want to do. They get complacent when God doesn't do something they want when they want something done. They get complacent when God doesn't do what they want done. And when God does do something, but it's not what they expected, they take this journey towards complacency and lack of faith. And because of that constant journey towards complacency and lack of faith, the Israelites often fell captive and into exile to other nations. And we as Christians, we can read the Bible. We read about the Israelites, we read about the Pharisees, we read about the disciples, and we say, no, I wouldn't have done that. No, we wouldn't have done that. No. We as a church, we are not like the Israelites. We trust God 100%. We trust in God and God alone. We never take things into our own hands because we know that God is our provider. Those silly, silly Israelites. No, I'm not like a Pharisee. I trust in God alone for my salvation. I trust in Jesus alone for my salvation. I never try and do good works. I never try and get brownie points from God. Silly, silly Pharisees. No, I'm not like Peter. I would never have sunk in the water if Jesus had called me out. What a stupid idea to suggest that I would sink because Jesus is in front of me. Silly, silly Peter. George Santayana says, those who cannot learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Those who cannot learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Clearly, the Israelites did not learn from history and they continually repeated it. And it's obvious as you look down the line, as you look down kind of like church history and us today, we are not learning from the Israelites' history and we continually repeat it. I think that we as a church struggle. We have the same trust issues as the Israelites do. I think we as Christians struggle with the same workful approval mentality as the Pharisees did. I think Christians struggle with the same doubt as Peter the disciple did. So my question to you is this. How big is your God really? Does your God hold the oceans in his hand? Is your God able to weigh the earth and everything in it? Do you know anyone that can advise God on what to do and what is good? Is your God able to see all the nations, all the people on this earth as a drop in the bucket? And you can draw two conclusions from this. The first conclusion could be this. God is too great to care. You know, God is amazing. Who can compare to God? The nations are like the bucket of this, are like a bucket to him. He picks up the whole earth as a grain of sand. Why would he care about me? Why would he care about my problems, however big or small, if God is so big, so great? That is the wrong conclusion to draw from this. And this is the right conclusion. God is too great to fail. God is too great to fail. Nothing gets on top of God. Nothing gets on top of God. And he can more than well handle what is going on in your life. And in fact, he wants to handle it. He wants to be part of it. And we all have problems in our life, right? All the time. Sometimes a lot more than other seasons of life. But we all have worries. And our worries sometimes outweigh our trust in God. But sometimes there are moments of undeniable faith in us where we go, do you know what, God? You can take my worries. Here they are. Have my worries. No, God, you haven't done anything. And you take your worries back and you put them back on yourself. But what we need to do, church, is we need to change this around. We need to get ourselves a bigger God and we need to get ourselves some smaller worries. This doesn't mean that the worries that we face are going to be any less hard. But when we have a mighty trust in God, our worries are dwarfed by his presence. And what we can do is we take our worries and our mighty trust in God and we can put our worries to God. We can give our worries to him. In fact, we can give our life to him. And we can have his mighty trust in God. So my question is this. How big is your God really? Can your God clear away your wilderness? Can your God fill in the deep valleys that you find yourself in? Can your God level the mountains that you are facing? We are all captive to something. And God will go to great lengths to pull you out of that captivity, through the wilderness and into freedom. Is it work? Is it marriage? Is it singleness? Is it idolatry? Is it university or money or cynicism? Is it complacency? Kids? Teenagers? Is it church? Are you captive to yourself? Are you captive to specific sin? Are you captive to burnout? Verse 3 and 4, clear the way through the wilderness, fill in the valleys, level the mountains. God will bring you through this wilderness. You will not bring yourself through this captivity and wilderness into freedom on your own. Only God. God will bring you through this wilderness as he leads you from captivity into freedom. And it's in the wilderness, church. It's in the wilderness. The wilderness will always lead to repentance. The wilderness is where renewal happens. The wilderness is where God shows us his love. The wilderness is where we often see and hear God most clearly. Now, everyone loves the spring and summer. Everyone loves the warm weather, the blue skies, the daffodils, the full-on trees that have sprouted all their leaves. But there are some times, church, where I have noticed that in the winter, I notice things that I don't notice in the spring and summer, because as I drive, I kind of go, huh, I didn't notice that there before, or I've never seen that before. How comes? And then I kind of realised, it's in the winter when all the trees die, when the trees are going through a season of wilderness, so to speak, they're going through a season of deadness, that they drop their leaves, and actually I was able to see through the trees and what was behind them. And I was seeing things that I've never seen before, because I'm so used to seeing maybe trees that are full of foliage. And it's kind of the same thing with God. We can see things more clearly often. We can hear God more often in the wilderness. When things are a bit more dead. When things are a bit more like, tough stuff going. We're going through more tough time. So you kind of think, well, how can I trust God with my problems? With everything that I'm going through, how can I, have a bigger trust in God and have my worries dwarfed by his presence in some ways? Well, it's this question again. How big is your God really? Has your God humbled himself and come down from heaven and taken on human form? Has your God lived a blameless life whilst at the same time being tempted the same way as us mere mortals? Has your God died for you? Has your God taken the punishment that you deserve? Has your God made you blameless and a saint? Has your God sealed you with his spirit? Has your God given you an unshakable, unwavering, unperishable inheritance that will never fade? This is the God that we read about in the Bible. To my non-believing friends that are listening to this, this is the God that I try and live for and trust in. To my believing friends, do you believe this? Really? Do you believe that God has already cleared the biggest mountain humanity faced? Do you believe he's already filled the biggest valley that we're all stuck in? Do you believe that he's already cleared away the thickest wilderness we were all lost in? And Ross, you're thinking, well, what on earth are you talking about? I'm talking about our sin, your sin, my sin, the sin that separated us from the Father. And that mountain, that valley, that wilderness has been cleared away by the death of Jesus. That mountain has been flattened by the death of Jesus. That valley has been filled in by the death of Jesus. That wilderness has been cut down by the death of Jesus. And we've all been there. Especially in that place of wilderness. And it's in that wilderness we often hear God speak to us the clearest. And it's in the wilderness where repentance and renewal happens. It's in the wilderness that we realise our sin. It's in the wilderness that we realise our disobedience. It's in the wilderness we realise our desperate need of a saviour. It's in the wilderness that we realise, see and experience God's sacrifice on the cross. It's in the wilderness that we see and experience the greatest demonstration of love. It's in the wilderness the knowledge we have of God takes the 18-inch journey from our heads to our hearts. And if God has done that, if he has cut that, flattened that mountain, if he has filled in those valleys, if he has cut down that wilderness, the biggest thing we are all facing humanity, then the problems that you're going through can be dwarfed by the presence of God. It is God himself that will get you through this, that has got you through this. You are his reward. You are his chosen and treasured possession. And you are now captive to him. And what a beautiful place to be. So believers and non-believers, I have one question for you to ask. How big is your God, really?